Remember, again, it takes a lot of patience to drive change, but making sure that you have that clear vision, you identify your adopters, your supporters, and sponsors to drive that forward will really help tackle any challenge when it comes to scaling.
Hi everyone, thanks for tuning into Roads of Design to help support our mission spread knowledge. We have a very special guest in today's episode. Let's welcome Aditi Sharma, an award-winning design executive passionate about inclusive, ethical and sustainable human-centered innovations. She's a recipient of prestigious Dr. Sarojini Naidu Award from the Government of India and 40 Under 40 Award from Business Elite, Women Who Builds Award by Globant, and has been named as Inspirational Woman in STEM by Authority Magazine. As a lecturer at Pratt, Aditi curates one of the top 10 UX programs offered in the United States. Aditi is a published design practitioner, is regularly invited to share her thoughts and leadership across prints, keynotes, and podcasts such as Campaign Life, Business Insider, AI and Data, Analytics Network, Interaction Design Association, and Brave UX, to name a few. As the head of design and research at Amazon, Aditi manages a global team that leads the consumer experience for 30-plus fintech products to help track revenue, usage, costs, and forecasts for AWS. Previously, as the head of payments design, executive director of digital experiences design at JP Morgan and Chase, Aditi set up a global design practice to build intelligent enterprise and fintech platforms. Today, we are diving into scaling design teams with Aditi Sharma. Aditi will share her journey into design, tips for scaling design teams, and her vision for future of design. Stay tuned for insights on aligning teams, hiring strategies, and managing feedback loops. We'll also explore how Aditi approaches challenges and stay inspired in her daily routine. Get ready for a super insightful conversation with Aditi Sharma on Nodes of Design podcast. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning into Nodes of Design. In this episode, we have a very special guest with us. Let us welcome Aditi. Hi, Aditi. Welcome to Nodes of Design.
Hi, Tej. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Aditi, how was your day so far?
It's been good. It's almost time to head to office. So before I do that, early morning here in New York, it's great to sit down with you and grab a coffee.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So if you could give a brief about yourself to our audience out there.
Yeah, sure. So for me, I think my career aspirations from the very beginning have been inseparable from the zest for design-infused sustainable impact. And I'm driven by looking at these key metrics of success with scalable programs that help teams find that creative confidence to deliver these customer outcomes at the intersection of business profitability, which is so important, and technical innovation so that we can keep up with what's happening around us. And over the years, I've worked across Fortune 100 clients, whether they come from corporate, government, and not-for-profit sectors, such as Amazon more recently, JP Morgan before this, Accenture Interactive, Walmart, British Heart Foundation, Doctors Without Borders. All of these firms have strengthened my mission to constantly explore this dynamism of design and make it core to business operations. Ultimately, using design to shape key strategic decisions that positively impact organizations, teams, and individuals. So for example, more recently at AWS as the head of research and design, I'm driving the build of 30 plus products that help our CFO and his team advise on making better decisions to improve revenue and lower cost to serve our customers. We've been able to induce 70% more customer research to drive product design builds, have set up an innovation arm to conceive new product ideas that disrupt the market by even centralizing disparate workflows. And we are leveraging technological trends with Gen AI and have scaled UX best practices with over 20 templates that elevate how we collaborate to deliver designs. So that's me in a nutshell.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So what was your journey into design? How did you start? And what are your tips to the beginners on starting the design journey?
Yeah, so my journey started in India. And as the youngest of three girls, I always approached life with this sense of inherent curiosity and awareness, even from an early age. I saw my parents find creative ways to sponsor causes such as girls' education, and we were dealing with very limited resources. I saw them design these posters, venture into underserved communities, and convince these parents to enroll their kids to go to school. I got involved really early on, and when I saw that my parents would convince these parents who were not interested to send their kids to school, these observations shaped my advocacy for social-led innovation, with the foundational belief that creative means have the power to save the world. As a kid, it was a tremendous idea, and I would start with posters. I would recycle discarded objects and build new products. This three-dimensional aspect of design inspired me to study product design at National Institute of Fashion Technology, in fact, at Hyderabad. But I always wanted to do more, to be involved in real-life projects. So I started internships as soon as my second year of college, and I was hired as a product designer with Jindal Architecture. It was an urban infrastructure company where I focused on material and product R&D with a human-centered approach. I designed urban street furniture and signages for the Commonwealth Games, which was a huge deal for this young designer. And I always wanted to delve into material R&D even more. And that's when I got interested to pursue industrial design. I received a scholarship to go to Loughborough Design School in the UK. And that's where I pursued inclusive design, accessibility practices, and ended up creating these kitchens for tiny houses, inculcating in me this idea of sustainability with design. Even when I was in the UK, I continued to pursue my passion for design-led societal change and consulted for clients in India, ultimately creating Adisha, a social impact design agency whose work was recognized by the President of India. During that time, we used to work with nominal budgets, and we successfully launched multiple societal enterprise programs, such as packaging for female condoms, a 2G network for rural communities to interact with central government, created an app from that. We created water recycling systems and an app to track how water was recycled and how it was reaching these underserved communities. I also worked on handmade products for mainstream consumers so that we could support local artisans. All of that took about 5 years. And during that time, I wanted to learn more. And I'm always driven by that curiosity. So I ventured to the US and enrolled in Stanford's inclusive design program with IDEO, then went on to pursue human-computer interaction at MIT. And then I ultimately landed a role at Accenture Interactive in New York City. And that was the first time when I started to consult for big clients like Walmart, DuPont, Cargill, ExxonMobil, and for ExxonMobil, I was in fact doing a sustainability project, and Doctors Without Borders as well. Then after that, after a few years of living out of suitcases and living out of these hotels, I decided to pursue something that was around New York. And that's when the opportunity at JP Morgan came about. This was the first time I was venturing into finance. And as the executive director at JP Morgan, I got to head payments operations while setting up a team in New York and also setting up a team in London. So I was traveling back and forth and ultimately founded a home in London. So that's where I was before I joined AWS. And during this time at JP Morgan, I was also a lecturer at Pratt Institute, and I got to curate one of the top UI UX design programs in the US. Ultimately, that led me to AWS now, when I'm heading research and design and building those products. So I've always been inspired to give back. And during this time, I've coached over 1,000 professionals in design. I've been very vocal within the design community, and I have been very fortunate to inspire women in STEM. And so just across my journey, if I were to give some tips, since you asked, if someone's starting their career journey in design, I would say Three things are absolutely key. One is constantly listening to help yourself and your teams around you set a baseline on current systemic problems, study market trends, and outline outcomes for functional, organizational, or corporate goals so that you can relieve these current pain points, but also lead to building this competitive edge for your team. So listening, being observational in your approach is very important. Then linking these dots across disparate journeys and market trends will help you unify cross-functional groups with a monumental North Star vision. So I would say that, again, linking these and connecting dots across disparate journeys is absolutely critical. And finally, always learning and completing that feedback loop, whether you're learning through set-based designs to make data-informed decisions, or you're just learning and progressing yourself by pursuing programs that are out there, and there's amazing content out there nowadays. So again, my three tips to all designers out there just starting on their journey would be listen, link, and constantly learn.
Thank you so much, Aditi, for sharing such wonderful journey and these great tips. So let's begin our episode today with scaling design teams. So in your perspective, how does the intricacies of scaling a design team contrast with the challenges of scaling other units within an organization?
Great question, Tej. And when I think about this challenge, even though the business value of design has been proven over and over again, it's still a challenge, in my opinion, to scale design teams and to set them up for success. We've seen reports from Human Factors International that fixing design mistakes during the development process can cost 10 times to remediate, while it can cost 100 times more to remediate after the product has been released. McKinsey has reported businesses with high design maturity having 4 times more revenue, 5 times more cost savings, and 6 times faster go-to-market speeds. Yet, 74% of companies fail at digital transformation programs due to a lack of design. I've always found myself at the forefront of major digital transformations across diverse enterprises, challenged to drive design with minimal resources, whether through my time at Accenture Interactive, consulting for clients like Cargill, DuPont, and Walmart, to JP Morgan when I was setting up these design teams across North America and UK, and now at AWS where I'm driving these products for fintech. Companies always want stuff built, and it becomes harder to prove the value of design with its qualitative nature. And if it's specially not tied to goals, it becomes even more harder. Design, when done right, as we all know, it's so hard to notice. On the other hand, disciplines like engineering are helping teams get a functional product built, you know, very specific to code guidelines. So there's a huge contrast between our disciplines when it comes to looking at the deliverables. But despite these challenges, I've been able to scale design and research with a show and tell technique. And I usually like to move my clients across these three innovation phases of ideation, incubation, and then scaling. And throughout these phases, my experience has taught me that design is most successful when it's not limited to designers. Each time, one has to play by the org rules. One has to take a pragmatic approach by defining these project-specific outcomes. Whether you are considering the budget, timeline, and resource limitations, it becomes important to talk to your stakeholders in language that they understand. And I found it really critical to approach all aspects of design with an eye towards maximizing its value to effectively negotiate with my stakeholders. So let me make it a little more specific. So for example, as an engagement manager at Accenture and fairly new in the world of consulting, my role required me to research on existing gaps. I would be sent out to our client sites and then figuring out the main challenge or the main problems to be solved for was something that was really hard to do. But using techniques like journey mapping, customer research, and starting to then pull out a North Star vision then defining that delivery team that would execute on that vision would usually help me and my client to align on common goals. This meant starting with a pilot team of two, usually with me and a researcher, usually sometimes just me, and then using the power of design and the power of the process to drive the value by setting that clear vision to go from strategy all the way to execution. Ultimately, I used to scale the teams to 20 plus professionals, starting with maybe just me or a team of two. So it starts with that sense of setting that urgency and unfreezing that status quo so that you can start to set new processes, new institutional approaches as well to help your clients. I continue to do this at Amazon as well, where I've been able to scale the team despite a hiring freeze using mathematical techniques, because again, you need to shift your approach based on the company that you're working for. So I've been able to evaluate time, effort, and value of design practices with my leadership so that we can go back to my stakeholders and say, okay, these are the goals that we are delivering. These are the features that we want to get built. These are above the line or below the line based on existing design capacity. Same thing happened at JP Morgan as well. We would usually start with a very, very small team, but then I was able to grow it four times by showing the value of these design-infused deliveries, finding adopters and sponsors, by slowly expanding the scope of influence for design, going into areas within the bank which were most convoluted. No designer wanted to touch that space. It was boring to a lot of these designers as well. But I could venture in and I could see these complex processes, break them down and simplified them. And that's where my stakeholders saw the value of design. So again, I hope these three examples across Accenture, JPM, and Amazon can help our listeners find that confidence that yes, it is possible to scale teams who are working on design and research, even though it might be harder than our counterparts.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So Aditi, could you share a personal experience where scaling possessed a unique challenge for you, and what are the innovative ways in which you have tackled it?
Yeah, great question. Let me jump a little more into the detail of a couple of examples that I just shared. And let's go recently again through my experience at Amazon. So more recently, as we were facing multiple crises from a lack of trust in fintech systems, we were also going through a hiring freeze. It became really hard to drive the impact of design and to drive the value of design in order to scale it. But one of the techniques that I've used in order to drive more value and earn trust by reducing the learning curve to use our products is a program called Common Patterns. And we conducted a survey last year throughout our products. And this was the first time a survey of that magnitude was being conducted, where we found 70% of AWS Finance customers that used more than one product, but 100% of them experience difficulties learning every system due to a lack of consistency of workflows. Even though there were experiences like bridging, maybe folks from finance would understand how bridging works when you're trying to balance out variances, approval workflows, notifications, say data grids. All of these experiences and workflows looked different across these products. So at Amazon, we go through a process called operational planning, and it usually happens before the start of next year. We, in fact, just went through it to define our priorities for 2024. So across that process, we identified over 170 instances of commonalities across 20 plus product workflows. And like I mentioned, there were things like approvals, bulk import, smart alerts, notifications, data visualization, commentary across users for better communication. So this year, we took on a goal to release two common patterns used by at least two fintech products But so far, to everyone's surprise, we are on a path to release 3 common patents this year. It was a very hard program to drive, especially looking at the consensus building that I needed to do across the organization to bring them together on using a common workflow. Just with that effort, we've been able to reduce the learning curve for customers, with 100% of our customers preferring our common patent over a bespoke feature that they were exposed to earlier. We've projected to save about 5,000 man hours just for design implementation alone. And we have 97% fewer bugs in production with no high severity tickets. So again, I think this process has taken this idea of building influence. And throughout my leadership journey, a framework that I have applied, again, I hope the listeners can use this framework to drive impact in their organization, especially when you're working on a large scale. A framework that I call Circles of Influence. And it's inspired by the work of Robin Dunbar, who worked at the university at Oxford. And he talked about this idea of having a clear vision, starting with that individual, and then that individual finding their support circle to get their opinion, get their thoughts. For me, it was my design team to get their buy-in so that we could start to design some of these workflows forming this working group, ultimately this two pizza team, where we could bring in our partners from engineering, from product, to make these design patterns come to life. Ultimately, we went beyond our team size and around a size of about 150, which is also known as the Dunbar number, essentially going across my org and convincing people to start adopting the pattern. That was a very hard thing to do because a lot of times they did not have this pattern on their roadmap. But ultimately, the vision and idea started to gain momentum, and familiar strangers, which were people who sort of know what we were doing, but did not really understand the depth and granularity of our work, we pulled them into the process as well. And that, again, led to us on a path of our strangers hearing about the vision. Now we are that ultimately led to a path where strangers started to hear about our vision, and we've joined forces to challenge the status quo and revolutionize the org for the better. So right now we are working with the Amazon Design System team, and we are on a path to potentially be adopted by more than 100 products across Amazon, making these common patterns a true success. So remember, again, it takes a lot of patience to drive change, but making sure that you have that clear vision, you identify your adopters, your supporters, and sponsors to drive that forward will really help you tackle any challenge when it comes to scaling.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So what are the primary indicators a company need to scale its design teams?
I would say that there are quite a few, and when you look at these companies, I think there are two factors that really impact an organization's ability to change. I would say it's age, which determines how deeply rooted the traditional practices are, and its size, which determines the scale of its problems. But organizations in competitive market environments experience higher growth. However, some organizations, when they come across crisis or they come across a stagnation, they usually don't survive a crisis. However, there are a few that do survive the crisis, and they are more likely to enjoy 4 to 8 years of continuous growth, as Larry Grainer at Marshall School of Business would tell us. So he did an entire study on understanding the patterns of evolution and revolution. So I was very interested to understand what makes a company survive a crisis, an aspect that I learned from Norman and Verganti. And the reason why I talk about this before I get into the indicators is because you can start to observe these patterns across organizations. So Norman and Verganti talked about this hill climbing paradigm, and they argued that as an idea is born, through incremental change, it reaches the peak of innovation on the current hill. Design-infused organizations are always ahead of the curve, while the skeptics are usually lagging behind to adopt the change. And more often than not, they don't survive crisis. So how do we empower our teams to always seek the next highest hill with radical innovation? And there's a few indicators, as you mentioned, that will help you catch on that, hey, my team is probably not on the path of innovation. And that becomes your responsibility as a design leader or as a designer to go in and start having the more difficult conversations. So for example, you might see that there's no data-driven decision making on product features. Rather, business decisions are being based on executive inkling or the loudest voice in the room. There's poor engagement and feedback during conception, which leads to severe usability issues. There's bugs in front-end adherence, or there's poor code quality overall. There's low customer adoption, satisfaction, very high customer effort scores, no product trust, and ultimately, the scales are usually tilting towards detractors over promoters. You will see high severity tickets from customers, and folks then just abandon your products. But how do I start on that path of remediation? I think as designers or as researchers or as content writers, one of our biggest tasks is to go to the root cause analysis so that you can start to pinpoint where issues exist. So for example, your goal could be to provide exceptional client service for your products, a construct that I think is driven by, for example, your goal could be to provide exceptional client service for your products. A construct for that would be to drive satisfaction or adoption. And then you can tie it to metrics such as reducing inquiry volumes or integrating data sources so that you can start to resolve majority of use cases by displaying information upfront to your customers. Second, I think is very important in terms of remediation is you need to build up your business domain knowledge. Design cannot be superficial anymore. Design practitioners should strive for authentic, deep engagement with users wherever possible. And this kind of contact may change the kind of questions you're asking or the solutions that you're providing to your stakeholders as well. Using customer anecdotes will help business leaders make their decisions not on abstract persona-based ideas, but on messy, but sometimes contradictory experiences of real people. And then map these gathered customer journeys using that system thinking design approach, going back and forth between these processes that may be backstage or front stage, and identify where gaps exist. Then start to fill in those gaps by suggesting some recommendations. I think just loose research without actual recommendations does not do anybody any good. Then you can use some of these projects to socialize the power of design best practices by picking up the juiciest problems at the strategic level that have the highest likelihood of moving the needle for customer experience. Take a participatory design approach with cross-functional teams and customers to make these projects successful. Use techniques like co-design, co-creation, experience prototyping, all of these techniques that entail investigating and responding to real needs. And lastly, what I would say is you don't need to be thinking out of the box. I think creatives have a ton of that pressure. You can start by building on existing assets that companies have already invested in. And then you're talking to them in their language to minimize deficits and looking at the work with a more positive lens, building on what individual people and teams have already created.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So Aditi, as design teams grow, how do you ensure everyone's aligned regarding the design philosophy and process all across?
Yeah, it's a hard one. So it usually starts, like I mentioned earlier, with the circles of influence, with that clear vision. And that's your main responsibility, I think, as a design leader, to set that clear vision, which is rooted in outcomes over deliverables. And it's so critical to empower your teams enabling them to think as system designers and not glorified wireframe production artists. By deeply rooting this why of your philosophy and process in goals, you can start to shape these goals to become more inclusive and harmonized against the organization's vision, which is where it all starts, your team's vision, and then your individual team members' career goals, so that they are driven to come into work every day and to drive that work forward. Once you have some of these goals defined, then you can start to tie each project that you undertake to the design process activities that move the needle. It's not about following a checklist. It's about looking at those activities and tying them to KPIs, like I mentioned, for the org, the team, and individual performance. For example, not just blindly doing research, rather keeping a record of the customer research sessions that you hosted, how many actionable insights came out of them, the number of design updates that came out of that, how it led to a percentage increase in CSAT or improvements in your NPS, and ultimately, how do those activities impact the business's bottom line. When you present these strong narratives to your stakeholder leadership, tied into actual business value, driven by your design philosophy and vision, you can continue to gather their support in the process of scaling your design team. I think another technique that has helped me and my team is hosting these monthly reviews with stakeholders so that we can start to track and report on how we are faring against these goals. And it also helps my team be very accountable and driven at the same time around the why of the process. Lastly, I would only add that make sure that the documentation or reporting progress is not becoming a blocker. At the end of the day, it's a creative process. It should be fun. So think about setting up automated auditing mechanisms. For us, we are using Asana boards that just help us track progress tied to actual goals as well. And then we generate these reports for our stakeholders without putting in a ton of effort to do that. So having that clear vision, having goals and having KPIs connected will help you continue to make sure that everyone's aligned and moving towards that definition of success for you, your organization, and your team members.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So what are the top considerations when hiring or rapidly scaling a design team? And how do you streamline the onboarding process to integrate new team members swiftly and efficiently into your new team?
It's a unique mix of talent when you're looking for those people who can come in and start setting up your team for scale. For me, I'm always looking for individuals with a strong sense of ownership, with that sense of entrepreneurship and self-starter attitude, so that no matter the challenge, they can go in and they can start to deliver value. Like I mentioned earlier, I think that sense of pragmatism in following a design process to drive value over following this checklist, right? Like, hey, yes, I did research, or yes, I have a journey map, or yes, I mapped my persona. But why did you do all of those activities? Knowing when to pull out which play from that toolkit so that you can drive business value, you can drive employee outcomes or customer outcomes is very important. So having that sense of knowing which process artifacts will help you move the needle becomes critical when I'm looking for that team member. And then ultimately, I would say I look for folks who have that inclusive mindset. And inclusivity is not just about demographical factors. Of course, they come into play, your gender, where you come from, your race, and all of those aspects today that are sometimes given more precedence over more subtle aspects of diversity, such as how do I experience the world, or how do I interact with the world with my cognitive abilities. So having an inclusive team, having team members who are inclusive in their approaches is very important to me. And I think when you have such environments where feedback can be shared openly. When feedback is received with grace as well, because the teams are inclusive, you can start to drive innovation. And everyone feels really involved in that why of the value that you're driving. The second part of the question was around onboarding. And I can tell you that just at Amazon, over the last year, we've been able to cut the onboarding times by almost 50%. That means we've been helping our designers and researchers become more effective faster, and start to form deeper relationships faster as well. How we did that, I think there's a couple of techniques that I can share with the listeners. One, you can start creating a repository of journey maps or service blueprints so that you can capture end-to-end processes. So when your designers are joining you or your researchers are joining you, you can give them an overview of how a workflow truly functions. Another technique that's helped is keeping some key customer interview recordings to bring some of those profiles to life so that it's not abstracted. Those, actual real life incidents can be shared much more broadly with your team. Having clear project goals is another key technique. So have a goal for your 30-day mark, your 60-day mark, your 90-day mark, and keep your team members accountable to drive progress through the 30, 60, 90-day timelines. Throughout this process, again, your team member will be as successful as you create the mechanisms for them to be successful as well. So make sure that you are outlining some key contacts for them to meet, to forge strong partnerships, not just within design, but venturing broadly, thinking about engineering or product partners or other profiles that they might be interacting with much more regularly. Finally, identify an advisor for them or an onboarding buddy so that in case as the hiring manager, they are not able to come to you regularly or don't feel comfortable asking some basic questions, they can find that buddy and they can go to them and ask questions like, hey, where do I find this Figma file? Or who should I contact when I'm thinking about this problem? Again, you want to make yourself as approachable as possible, but having an onboarding buddy will give and create a friendly environment for this new joiner on your team.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So how do you handle feedback loops in a bigger team, ensuring that the design quality and consistency remains good?
Before I actually answer the key part of the question there, I think let me tell you how I've set up the teams, and I've gone through a ton of learnings through that process. Today at Amazon, I've divided the teams up and organized them in pods. Each pod is driven by customer outcome or a business outcome. Each pod also has a pod lead, usually a manager or a senior manager who's driving the build of multiple product initiatives. They are supported by principal designers, senior designers, and associates so that we have a good balance of experienced designers and new folks who have joined the industry to create a space for constant innovation and learning. So when you think about this structure, it makes it really manageable and you can start to scale the impact of design. To drive feedback loops, I've set up two types of mechanisms. One, thinking about best practices by publishing templates. And second, by conducting regular peer reviews. So let's talk about the first one. Just with the templates alone, we have around 20 plus templates so far. And we've laid out how to conduct different types of, say, workshops, whether they are co-creation workshops, evaluative workshops, or research like, during your exploration process, which might be more generative type of research, during experimentation process, where you have, a couple of concepts that you want to test out with customers, or evaluative research, which might be prior to release or post release with telemetrics to track the usage of your products. We've also defined templates for branding guidelines. Like I mentioned, common patterns. We've also set up some of these interface workflow patterns so that we can just avoid common misses from the get-go. These mechanisms and templates help us move with velocity without a lot of dependencies within the team or within the pod or on the manager or on me. Each team member is empowered to deliver quality through using these templates, and they continue to add back to the templates. We continue to update our templates as well as we learn more where things probably are falling short or there's new advancements out there in the industry so that we have the best practices always available for our design teams. The other aspect to manage these feedback loops is to set up these crit mechanisms. And I think, again, going back to how the pod has been structured, each product designer is collaborating with product and engineering counterparts to ensure that the design is meeting the acceptance criteria, but they're also going a step further and they're responsible for ingraining customer experience benchmarks with everything that we deliver. Each design pod then is conducting daily stand-ups to unblock teams. They're also hosting weekly reviews so that they can guide key decisions. They're also making sure that research is being conducted. So it's happening at the designer level and then at each pod level so that the design details can be ensured to be of a certain quality. Then at a team level, we have design studio time for any items that require the broader leadership team to analyze, common patterns or to give that final stamp of approval, especially for key strategic programs, so that before development starts, we are all aligned. And finally, as I'd mentioned earlier, to ensure that we are accountable and also to drive visibility with our org leadership, we are hosting these monthly stakeholder reviews covering these key design or research deliverables before they go into production. So I think having that balance of the scalable templates and then having the balance of self-driven design crits help ensure quality and consistency across the org.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So given the rapid changes in the industry and technology, how do you envision the future of design teams?
We recently went through so much crisis in 2020, of course, with the pandemic. And I believe that crisis has taken us as an industry from evolution to revolution. When the pandemic hit, it changed how we operate as a global economy, as a design industry. And now we're more dependent on virtual sources. You and I are having this conversation over Zoom, something that shot up, especially during the pandemic time. These moments of crisis have led to these moments of pure genius for us, especially with the AI wars happening around us with OpenAI, ChatGPT, Google's Bard AI, or our very own Bedrock at Amazon. And by definition, there's no training data that's available for AI to learn and generate what's never been done before. So it takes us humans to work collaboratively to create new approaches, new programs, new products, and just some amazing creative work. I don't think that AI, when I talk about it, will replace our creative job, but something that I'm truly excited about, it's really helping our teams feel more empowered. You know, stats will tell us that AI is expected to add $1 trillion worth of business value this year alone. And automation efforts will double the world's productivity by 2025. Those are staggering numbers. AI automation can handle repetitive and time-consuming tasks, allowing us designers and creatives to focus on higher-level creative and strategic activities. Designers can automate tasks like, say, data collection, analysis, including accessibility considerations in content generation, increasing our efficiency and productivity overall in the process. We are seeing companies like Adobe and Jasper with their Gen AI capabilities that are helping improve design productivity and the quality of our overall output. I think we will also reach a point where designers will be able to create intelligent interfaces using this idea of personalization with specific user inputs and preferences. And these interfaces can be further supported with human-like chatbot conversations so that we are creating these personalized recommendations, ultimately improving the customer experience that impacts businesses' bottom lines. Even though all of this technology has a ton of promise, I don't think it will fulfill its potential without trust and good governance. So as creatives, as people who are always inclusive in our approaches, we need to be constantly mindful of ethics. Again, thinking about consumer data and privacy, security, copyright, and data ownership, the data model training transparency so that there are no biases in how we are training these Gen AI models. And finally, but thinking about environmentally conscious AI model usage. Again, I think our responsibility as creatives is to use this technology, but also be mindful of unintentional consequences that may come with it. So even though I'm really excited about the rapid change with AI and specifically Gen AI capabilities, I think the future of our design teams can be in really good hands with more responsible people who are driving the technology changes forward.
Thank you so much, Aditi, for sharing all these wonderful insights with us. So could you please share with us, how does your day look like? Any interesting stories?
Yeah, interesting stories. Okay, probably I can share with you maybe how my day looks like, because every day is interesting in its own way. Faced with challenges every day almost, and each of them is so unique. But I can share with the listeners how I like to organize myself to tackle those challenges. First, I always like to outline my to-do list before I leave for the day. So leave for the day is a fairly loose term, because my day varies depending on how much work is on the table. But having that to-do list helps me start my next day with a very organized mindset as well. I usually start my day with some meditation. I like to squeeze in a walk if I can. I'm really connected to my parents, so I try to call them, especially during the morning hours, because they overlap really well with Eastern time zone and India time zone. On my way to office, I like to get through the emails. And if there's any new high priority task, I usually add them to my to-do list so that when I get to the office, I can start with these high priority tasks. Usually my week starts with a leadership stand-up as well. So my team of leaders, we get together, we go through these priority tasks, which might just be, of course, for me, or more widely for the entire team. So we discuss those high priority tasks as a leadership team. I also host reviews for stakeholders to drive that cross-org collaboration. And I always try to make time for one-on-ones throughout my week. But, you know, finding ways to give back through mentorship or coaching. So I'm a part of Amazon's Women Mentorship Circle, where I actually have been mentoring some of the women who are in STEM, again, trying to give back and trying to empower them as well to rise up to leadership positions. So yeah, that's how my day looks like with the to-do list, with my emails, meeting with my leadership team, and hosting some one-on-ones and stakeholder reviews.
Thank you so much, Aditi. So we'll conclude the show by your three favorite book recommendations and people who inspire you the most in this space.
Yes, there's a few books. And when you ask me to just narrow it down to three, I think that's a hard one. But let me start with a book that I read recently, Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. As Steve Jobs said, you can't connect the dots looking at the future. So one must look at the history of events to understand what's going to happen. So this book, Sapiens, covers the history of humankind so that we can understand how we arrived here and what's next for us as well. So I highly recommend it. More specifically, to drive influence, I think there's two books that I really enjoyed. One, Finding Your Why by Simon Sinek. And it's a classic, and it just shows how important it is to find your ikigai, which is a Japanese word for your reason for being or your sense of purpose. Then another one that I like is Think Again by Adam Grant, and that examines the science behind changing your mind and persuading others to change their minds, which I think is such a critical skill for design leaders. I'll just add one more. It's called Creative Confidence by David and Tom Kelly. It's a fairly famous book out there. And it implores us to have the courage to be creative through setbacks or success, no matter what. It ties into the people who've been great influencers. The work from Debbie Millman, who hosts the podcast for Design Matters. I've been listening to that for a while and I got to meet Debbie, which was a total fan moment for me. Looking at the work of Pentagram, I think the agency, it's just amazing to look at their work. So I think the agency overall is doing some incredible work as well. I know it doesn't fit in our field, but my mother has always been a constant source of inspiration for me. So yeah, I would say my mother as well is a big influencer.
Thank you so much, Aditi, for sharing all these wonderful recommendations and all these great insights with us. So we are looking forward to host you again in our upcoming episode. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Tej. It was a wonderful experience.
I'm thrilled to announce that this March, in honor of International Women's Day, we will be featuring a series of episodes showcasing inspiring female leaders in design. Each episode will highlight the journeys, achievements, and insights into these remarkable women who are not only shaping the future of design but also paving the way for the next generation of female leaders. Join us as we celebrate their contributions, explore their perspectives, and share their stories of success, resilience, and innovation. So stay tuned and subscribe to Nodes of Design to catch the special episodes throughout March. Let's come together to honor and uplift the voices of women in design as we continue to inspire and empower each other in our creative endeavors.